Hello, hello, and welcome back to Behind the Walls of the World Psychiatric Hospitals. I'm your host, Dr. Sarah Gallup, and today I have a true crime story for you. It's the story of someone who would later end up at Danvers State Hospital because of the crime committed. And I'll let you decide for yourself whether you believe this person was delusional, a religious fanatic, as the newspapers would say, or if you think the act was intentional. This entire episode requires a trigger warning for child death by homicide. Throughout my reading for this case, I found myself frequently saying, "That's really messed up." So if that doesn't sound like something that you'd like to listen to, because it is a very sad story, then feel free to skip this episode and come back next week. But if you'd like to stick around, you'll get a glimpse into what I often work with. Many of my patients have committed similar crimes, maybe not for the same reasons, but for reasons that make them make just as much sense to them as they did to the man in this story. So my sources for this episode will be a blog for the podcast In My Footsteps, as well as several original newspaper articles, thanks to newspapers.com. So for now, come on in and get comfortable as we go behind the walls of Danvers State Hospital. I'm going to do something a little different in telling this story. I want you to hear the story as it was told through the press at the time, without my filter. So without further ado, this is the story of the life, crime, and possible escape of Charles F. Freeman. This article is extremely long and admittedly repetitive. It's taken from the May 2nd, 1879 edition of the Boston Globe, the day following the offense. Butchery. A crazy father plunges a sheath knife into the bosom of his sleeping child because, as he says, the Lord God commanded him to make the terrible sacrifice. The mother assists in the deadly deed. A sorrowful example of religious frenzy. The murderers arrested. The father's story of the affair. The whole of the village of Pocasset is one blaze of excitement over the horrible death of Edith Freeman. It appears that the crime is much more horrible than was at first supposed, and it was with the consent of the wife of the murderer that the crime was committed. On Wednesday night or Thursday morning, Charles F. Freeman brutally murdered his youngest child. The particulars of the affair are as follows. Freeman is a farmer living in Pocasset, and for the past 10 months, he has been engaged in carrying the mails from Pocasset Depot to the post office. About 12 months ago, he became a convert to the faith of the Second Adventists, and since that time has neglected his farm and devoted his time to the study of the Bible. About a week ago, he claimed to his wife to have received a revelation from the Most High, which required from him a sacrifice of one of his family, but he was in doubt as to which one. The matter was talked over, but no conclusion was reached. On Thursday, a meeting of the Adventists was held at his house, but nothing was said outside of the meeting about anything unusual having occurred. On Thursday night, Seth Redding, a constable of the town, called on the family of A.P. Davis, who is one of the principal members of the Adventists, and he thought that a daughter of Mr. Davis, a young lady of 16 years, was particularly serious. The young lady and Mr. Redding, who is a young man, were left alone, and she soon began to cry. Mr. Redding asked her what was the matter, and she, after some persuasion, told him that at a meeting at Freeman's house that afternoon, Freeman had confessed to having killed his youngest child. Redding then went to one of the selectmen, David Nye, and related what he knew about the case. Mr. Nye doubted the story and said that he had better investigate further. Redding then went to Foster Howard, a man who was in sympathy with him and a convert to the Advent faith, and asked him, Howard, if he knew about Freeman's killing his daughter. Howard said it was so, and then Redding waited around Freeman's house until morning. Soon after daylight, Redding, according to his own statement, went into the house and asked for Freeman. At the same time, seeing him on a bed in an adjoining room, he said to Mrs. Freeman that she need not disturb her husband, as all he wanted to know was that he was in the house. Soon Freeman came out of his room and, after shaking hands with Redding, asked him how he felt, at the same time stating that he, Freeman, did not feel well. Redding said he did not wonder after what had occurred. Freeman said, "It is horrible," and told Redding the whole story, which the latter repeats as follows. The murderer's story. "You know," said Freeman, "that I had a revelation about a week ago in which the Lord appeared to me and told me to kill one of my family and offer it as a sacrifice. Well, he did not say what one, but on Thursday morning, on awaking from a sound sleep sometime around 2 o'clock, the Lord appeared to me and informed me that the victim of the sacrifice was my pet, my idol, my baby, Edith. I awoke my wife, and we talked the matter over and prayed to the Lord for guidance and directions, that if it was God's will that the cup might pass from me, and ended by saying, 'God's will be done.' The Lord said that it was necessary, and so I arose, went out of doors to my shop, and got a sheath knife. Then I came in, and placing the lamp on the chair near the bed, I drew back the clothes and raised my hand to strike the blow, fully believing the Lord would stay my hand, but he did not, and the knife descended. My darling turned as the knife struck her, and lifting her hands and opening her eyes, said, 'Oh, Papa.' My oldest child became awakened and was taken by my wife to our bed, and I took the little victim of the Lord's into my arms and held her until she died. I then went to bed with my dead darling, and in the morning I sent several notes to the neighbors for them to come to a meeting that afternoon. When the company arrived, I told them the whole story, and they agreed that I did right. What I did was at God's direction, and I am content to leave the matter in his hands, confident that he will guide and direct me." Redding then waited around the house until the arrival of the deputy sheriff. "When he arrived," said Redding, "I, of course, left the whole matter in his hands." It appears that as soon as the deputy sheriff arrived at Pocasset, he at once took Freeman and his wife into custody and started with them for Barnstable. The nearest place to take the train was at Monument. Freeman and his wife boarded the train at this place in company with Deputy Sheriff Harris and Medical Examiner Smith. They were, of course, the observed of all observers and occupied seats alone. While the officers were in another part of the car, a reporter engaged Freeman in conversation and said, "You don't feel uneasy at going to jail?" He turned around quickly and said, "No, why should I?" When asked how he came to do the deed, he replied with an evident delight that he was a second Abraham. He loved his child better than himself and expected the heavens to fall rather than he should be permitted to kill his dear one. He related the circumstances of the horrible deed, substantially stated above, and Mrs. Freeman gazed rapturously on her husband as he recited the terrible tale and corroborated his statements regarding her belief in this gospel. As he expounded his views to the reporter, he became very enthusiastic, finally getting on his knees on the seat and facing the back of the car before many knew who he was, and was soon addressing the 100 passengers in the car. He said in the course of his remarks, "Either the child will be raised from the dead in 3 days, or she will be translated bodily to heaven." In his talk, he exhibited great familiarity with both the Old and the New Testaments. "I was awakened at 2 o'clock in the morning by the Spirit of God, which commanded me to sacrifice my youngest child. I told my wife. She had first tried to dissuade me, but finally agreed that it was the hand of God and ceased all objections. I arose, got the knife, and went into the room where the children were sleeping. The oldest awoke. I told her to move into mother's room. I lifted the knife over the sleeping child, but no signs came from heaven, and I struck the fatal blow as tenderly as I could. I then took the bleeding child in my arms and wept bitterly. I lay down with it in bed. It seemed as if God had forsaken me as he did Jesus on the cross. I prayed and wept bitterly, and in the morning felt gloriously. God rewarded my soul with light, and I went to the depot at peace with God and all the world. I notified the selectmen and constables to be present at the meeting in the afternoon, but none came. When the reporter asked if he expected to hang, he replied, "No, God has commanded me to thus rudely awaken the world from its present condition, and God will justify his servant. If it had been my wife or the other child, I should have done the same. I begged God to take my life, but that was not to be. I loved the child better than myself." An animated discussion took place before the train reached Barnstable. Freeman, in stating his belief, said, "Only the good have immortality. My child and all other children will be saved. Soul and body are one and will slumber in the ground until the judgment day." He told the medical examiner that he would not allow them to call him insane, for everybody in town knew he was not. He was averse to being defended by the use of money and has perfect faith that God will bring him through safely, break the jail bars, and not suffer him to hang. "Still, if it is God's will, I will die cheerfully," said he. Many of the passengers propounded many theological questions, and when he could not answer, he said he trusted the promises of God. He presented an unparalleled picture of what he called faith in God and gloried continually in the fact that the world would in 3 days see the greatest triumph in the history of Christianity. He was very calm and indifferent to his trial, and upon the arrival of the train in Barnstable was taken quietly to the jail without being handcuffed. Charles F. Freeman was born in Highgate, Vermont in 1846. And is therefore 33 years of age. He is of a light complexion, medium height, pleasant, open countenance with bright blue eyes, which meet a person with whom he engages in conversation with unflinching gaze. He worked at his trade of heeling shoes in Lynn for 3 years, and in 1874 came to Pocasset, where he has been engaged in farming ever since. He served 3 years in the army during the war, and was married to Miss Hattie R. Ellis of Pocasset in 1868. The result of their union has been 3 bright children: Lillian, who died at the age of 2 months in 1870, Bessie Mildred, the only one now living, born in 1872, and Edith, the one who, had she lived, would have been 5 in August. Freeman was in moderate circumstances at the time of the murder, but had been in very poor circumstances for some time previous. At the age of 21, he experienced religion, but says he was beat out of it by backsliding Christians. In February 1878, he was converted to Adventism and has been a very earnest worker and speaker for the cause since, and recognized as a leader of the Second Adventists here for over a year. Mr. and Mrs. Freeman have always lived happily together and idolized the bright children which had comforted them. He was always respected in the community. He is a man of nervous temperament, easily excited, a great Bible student, a good speaker, and an enthusiast in this particular form of religious belief. The meeting at Freeman's house. The invitation had been extended to the townspeople to be present, as important revelations would be made during the afternoon. Only a score of friends assembled, however, and these were all of the Advent faith. Freeman called the meeting to order and thought it best to dispense with the usual singing and prayer. He then said he was very sorry outsiders and unconverted were absent. The Lord had showed him that the kingdom of Christ was near at hand and that the presence of the Lord had been in the house for 2 weeks. He then gave a religious discourse for a half an hour and said, "The question has been submitted. Shall I give up my child? Shall I offer her as a sacrifice as Abraham offered Isaac?" I then laughed at the idea. The Lord brought it nearer to me and pointed out the child. He then went into a statement of the details of the murder, and for a few moments, the greatest consternation was manifested. The visitors were astounded and refused to believe it until their eyes saw what their conscience refused to accept. After this, Mrs. Freeman made a few remarks endorsing everything Freeman had said. She was followed by others present who believed that it was the will of the Lord and that Freeman had obeyed the commands of God. The company then separated. How the sect originated in Pocasset. In February 1878, Captain Bray, a Baptist evangelist of Boston, began a series of meetings in Pocasset and held them with moderate success for a short period of time. During the progress of the meeting, several dissensions from his views were taken by several present, and it assumed a serious shape. When Charles A. Brown of Orrington, Maine, appeared on the scene last October and advocated the Second Advent doctrine, he was refused the privilege of speaking at any of the Methodist meetings, and the result was the holding of separate meetings for expounding of the Advent faith. The first meeting was held at the residence of Mrs. Harriet Swift. After this, meetings were held nightly for several weeks at the Redbrook House. Out of these meetings grew the present society, which has held the meetings regularly at the Redbrook House and now numbers about 25 members, and is officered as follows. Secretary, Mrs. Etta Handy. Treasurer, Mr. Nathaniel Wing. Superintendent of Sunday School, A.P. Davis. Freeman's influence over his associates. Mrs. Freeman has been as fanatical and superstitious as her husband and believes as fully as he does in the revelation which was relayed to her by him. In obedience to his wishes, she made no opposition to the accomplishment of his purpose. Outside of his own house, nothing was known of the affair of butchery until the following afternoon, when in response to invitations which he sent around the village, the members of the society gathered at his residence. Then he declared to them with solemn voice and grotesque language and gesture that he had a revelation from the Lord for them, and proceeded with the relation of the terrible deed, which he said was committed by the command of the Lord, and that the Lord would raise the child again on the third day. The enthusiastic Adventists had before this event regarded him with awe and veneration, and now, when the dead body of his child lay before them, instead of its undeceiving them, the superstition took root more deeply. None of those present in the afternoon mentioned the matter, the whole society evidently being so under the influence of the faith as expounded by him, that if they do not actually countenance the act, they are at least endeavoring to shield Freeman. To such an extent has this purpose been carried that they absolutely refuse to state the circumstances of the deed, even to the authorities. It is intimated that all the parties who are present at Freeman's house Thursday afternoon will be arrested for being accessory after the murder. The funeral will take place on Sunday. As the little innocent lay on the bed in the parlor of Davis's house, it presented a beautiful, as beautiful, and at the same time, heart-rending picture. The child's grandmother, Mrs. Harriet Swift, stood by and related in substance the facts already given. She is a very intelligent and well-appearing lady, and conversed with perfect freedom with the reporter. She was present at the meeting in Freeman's house Thursday afternoon and related the circumstances of the occasion as follows. So, if you can believe it, that was all one article written the day after the crime occurred. So, as it sort of alluded to, little Edith's body stayed in the same place where she died. After the Adventists had come over and been subjected to it, after the deputy sheriff and the medical examiner had come to see it, and after journalists had come to see it, and apparently after a bunch of others had come to see it too, there seemed to be no dignity for this poor child. In a May 3rd, 1879 edition of the Boston Globe, it said, quote, "The body of the child still remains in the same place as when seen by the Globe reporter on Friday and has been viewed by hundreds from all parts of the county during the 2 days it has passed. During this evening, several contributions of flowers, wreaths, and crosses were received from sympathizing friends. Bessie Mildred, the other child, is still at the house of James H. West, whither she was taken from school on Friday morning, and knows nothing of the horrible fate of her sister and companion. It has been thought advisable by friends not to break the news to her until after the funeral. Freeman had a few weeks ago announced his intention of preaching soon, and Mildred is under the impression from what has been told her concerning his absence that he is away from home working for the Lord as an evangelist. It has been previously stated that Mildred was to reside with Mrs. Harriet Swift as soon as it was deemed wise and expedient to acquaint her of the facts, but this denied by rumors which are current this evening that Mr. MacDonald, an agent for the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, visited Pocasset today and made a personal and thorough examination of the case in question, and after hearing the pros and cons, has come to the conclusion that Mrs. Swift is not a proper person to care for the girl. It is said that he will recommend a different plan of action in a few days. About 15 of the prominent members of the Advent Society met at Davis's house this evening and compared notes and observations concerning the situations of affairs. It was thought by several present that no Advent services should be held tomorrow in view of the threatening attitude of the people. After some animated discussion on the point, it was agreed to hold a session of the Sunday schools this morning at the Redbrook House and to omit the usual Sunday evening prayer meeting. They complain they have been unjustly treated by the citizens and feel that Adventism should not be condemned for what one member of the faith has done. They claim there is nothing in the Advent faith which authorizes such a sacrifice as Freeman made, and also claim that he was badgered and abused by the members of other churches who took advantage of his weakness of mind and so wrought upon him as to make him almost insane upon this point. They aver that he was continually under fire from the guns of Methodist theological expounders and was accosted by them whenever he appeared on the street. Some of those present believed in the idea that life would be restored on the third day, and if not, a general translation of the body to heaven would take place. They could not or would not conceive of any other manner in which God would show his power. While the above view of the case was accepted by many, yet others believed that neither would take place Sunday morning. Charles Freeman and his wife Hattie had been taken to jail and were arraigned 3 days after they arrived. The following is taken from the May 5, 1879 edition of the Boston Weekly Globe. Quote, "The Freemans in court, arraigned for murder, they plead not guilty, committed to jail where they will spend the summer." Charles F. Freeman was brought before trial justice Smith K. Hopkins on Saturday morning. Deputy Sheriff Harris first read the warrant arresting both Charles F. Freeman and his wife, Harriet R. Freeman. The complaint was then read by the justice, to which Freeman and his wife pleaded not guilty. Testimony of Deputy Sheriff Harris. Arrived at Pocasset Friday afternoon, found a large crowd standing outside the house. Freeman and his wife were in the house and cordially welcomed me. Went in with medical examiners Dr. J. M. Smith of Barnstable and Dr. George N. Munsell of Harwich. Found the child lying on its left side on the bed where it was killed. Freeman made no resistance when I took him to the train en route for Barnstable Jail. Testimony of Dr. J. M. Smith. Arrived at the house at about 3:15. Found the child, as stated by Sheriff Harris. Made an examination of the wound. Found it to be done with a knife, which pierced the child's body below the fifth and sixth ribs under the armpit, being about 1 1/4 inches in length and 3 inches in depth, sufficient to enter the heart. Thought the child could not have lived more than 2 or 3 minutes. Called for the father and mother of the child, and in its presence asked him if he took its life. Freeman said, "Yes, by order of the Lord, as Abraham was ordered to sacrifice his son Isaac, and if the Lord had not meant that I should kill her, he would have stayed my hand." And when the wife was questioned, she said she assented to all and knew the child had gone in to kill his child, whom he loved as he did his life. She went into the room about 3 minutes after the deed was done and found the child breathing its last. No other witnesses being called, they were taken to jail to wait for trial at the October term. When Freeman was taken to jail, no handcuffs were put on him, but his wife, taking his arm, followed the sheriff to their summer quarters. While waiting at the courthouse this morning, Freeman and his wife conversed together, and occasionally he would sing, "Nearer, my God, to thee," and often smile. They both listened attentively to the testimony, and Freeman said that all the doctor had said was true, that he had been very fair in relating the conversation. When taken to jail Friday night, he was put in a cell. He did not want any supper, and in the morning, he did not eat much breakfast. Not a tear was shed by either party, or any evidence of sorrow shown. He said the child would come to life Sunday morning, or the Lord would take it bodily up to heaven. End quote. Charles and Hattie Freeman spent months in jail. They were found guilty of their charges in October 1879, but remained in jail to await sentencing. They were back in the newspapers again in January 1880, 8 months after the murder of their daughter. This is from the January 29th, 1880 edition of the Boston Globe. Charles F. Freeman, the career and crime of the Pocasset fanatic, his wife a willing partner in his singular crime, the probable punishment of the irresponsible couple. The investigation of Charles F. Freeman's case will take place tomorrow at Barnstable, before Judge Morton. No jury have been summoned. The witnesses will probably be Folsom of the State Board of Lunacy, the superintendents of insane asylums at South Boston and Taunton, and medical examiner Munsell from Harwich. The preponderance of evidence will favor the insane idea, and the current belief in Barnstable is that Freeman will be sent to the insane asylum instead of being tried for murder. Until within a few days, Freeman has refused counsel, asserting that the Lord will provide. But it is said he is accepted as advisors A.W. Boardman from Boston and C.A. Tabor from Lynn. Mrs. Freeman is said to be as enthusiastically religious and Adventistic as before the murder. The investigation will develop no materially new facts, although the documentary evidence of medical experts who will testify is very voluminous. The article then recounts the murder in vivid detail. I don't think we particularly need to revisit it. The only new information or important information from that section is that Freeman said he had been having headaches for 2 weeks prior to the murder and was furiously studying scripture to figure out why he was, quote, haunted by visions. He also had told his wife that he wasn't sure which of the family members had been chosen as the sacrifice, so even she, Hattie, should be prepared that it could be her. That's kind of creepy. Meanwhile, the body of little Edith had been removed to the house of Alden P. Davis, a leading Adventist, and funeral services were held Sunday from the Methodist Church. The exciting scenes and the disgraceful conduct of Davis during the progress of the funeral services need not be rehearsed at this time. Public sentiment all over New England was raised to a high pitch of excitement, and fears of violence to the Pocasset Adventists were entertained for a long time after the murder. A large and enthusiastic indignation meeting was held at the hotel the day following the funeral, and radical speeches were made. Several hearings were held by District Attorney Knowlton and Judge Hopkins of Barnstable, and the matter was thoroughly investigated. The case was discussed by pulpit and press throughout the country, and during the few weeks succeeding Freeman's incarceration, he talked with almost everybody. But as the true phase of the matter began to dawn upon his mind, he refused to talk except to his legal advisors. He has maintained throughout a strong faith in the justification of his act and has grown strong and healthy during his term of confinement. During the month of May, he made several predictions, one of which was that the world was coming to an end on the 21st day of that month, but none of which have been realized. Mrs. Freeman has not taken the matter so coolly as her husband, and during her confinement in the jail was somewhat enervated by mental depression and sorrow. She has now become reconciled to the decree of fate and is disposed to make the best of the situation in which she is placed. Freeman has refused to have a lawyer defend him and says he will rely on the power of God to release him from his prison cell. At the term of the grand jury in October last, Freeman was found guilty of willful murder and his wife discharged on the same complaint. It is the opinion of many that the coming trial will not be very exhaustive, but will result in the confining of Freeman in the insane asylum. The course of the trial will be watched with eager interest by all concerned. End quote. And they were right about that. A special afternoon edition of the January 29th, 1880 Boston Globe gave a report of the trial that morning as it began. Quote, "The judicial examination in the case of Charles F. Freeman, the Pocasset murderer, was begun here this morning before Judge Morton of the Supreme Bench. The court came in at 9 o'clock, and 5 minutes later, Freeman came in with Deputy Sheriff Whitcomb. He had a Bible in his left hand and entered the courtroom with an elastic step. Those unacquainted with him would not, from his demeanor, have selected him as the one charged with a terrible crime. He appeared very much unconcerned, but after the trial began, carefully paid attention to all the testimony. He was neatly dressed, and his general appearance indicated that he had lost none of his physical strength or vigor during his term of imprisonment. His wife entered the courtroom with her mother, Mrs. Harriet Swift of Pocasset, shortly after, and took a seat within the jury enclosure. As she entered, she nodded pleasantly to Freeman, who responded with a pleasant smile of recognition. She, too, paid much attention to the testimony, and no attention to the scrutinizing gaze of the 100 persons in attendance. Attorney General Marston, having moved that counsel be assigned, the judge appointed A.W. Boardman of Boston and C.A. Tabor of Lynn, after which Marston moved for Freeman's arraignment. Judge Morton moved for Freeman's arraignment. Judge said it was usual in such cases where suggestions had been made to the court that the prisoner was of unsound mind, incapable of testifying or pleading himself to hear evidence on the point before he was asked to plead. Dr. Charles J. Wood of Pocasset was the first witness called. He testified that he had known Freeman several years. He had always enjoyed a good reputation. He was generally enthusiastic on the subject of religion. He had no vices. Isaiah C. Inman, jailer of the Barnstable Jail, testified that Freeman was in an excited condition when he came to jail in May last, in his appearance, conduct, and conversation. Freeman had several signs during his term in jail. One in particular, when the southeast corner of the window in the upper tier of the jail blew in, and he called witnesses' attention to the fact. He said it was a sign to him that he was a cornerstone or a starting point for others. He saw several signs suggestive of this calling. He has never appeared unwell during his imprisonment and has always taken food readily. Mrs. Harriet Swift of Pocasset, Freeman's mother-in-law, was next called and testified that he was sober, industrious, humane, and a good husband, a kind and indulgent father, and not so avaricious for worldly affairs after his conversion as he was before. She related the circumstances of the visit of Freeman's brother-in-law, Captain Hardy, who threatened to shoot Freeman for having led his wife into the Advent movement. She gave information regarding the Advent faith and said the sect in Pocasset numbered 20 members. During her description of the Advent meetings, Freeman paid the greatest attention and nodded approvingly to her statements. Dr. Charles F. Folsom of Boston was called and testified that he had visited Freeman 5 times. In answer to a question as to whether he was of sound mind now, he said, "I should say he is decidedly of unsound mind and not capable of comprehending the charge of murder. He is neither capable of comprehending this charge, nor in a proper condition to give any defense or of to be any assistance to his counsel at all. His disease is a form of delusional insanity produced from several causes: hereditary tendency, religious excitement, a mild sunstroke which occurred 3 years ago and from which he has never recovered, his change from a life of previous excitement to one of quiet and steady habits, and his physical condition also from loss of sleep previous to the murder. Dr. James H. Denny of South Boston testified more minutely as to his condition and corroborated the facts shown by Folsom. Judge Morton considered the testimony and ordered that Freeman be returned to jail until the May term of the Supreme Court. End quote. But the eager public didn't have to wait until May, though. In February 1880, they got the news they were waiting for. And this is from a February 4th, 1880 edition of the Pittsfield Sun. Quote, "Charles Freeman, the second Adventist who killed his five-year-old daughter in Pocasset, Massachusetts last May, has been adjudged insane by medical experts and will be sent to a lunatic asylum. Freeman still persists in asserting that the sacrifice of his child was a just and proper act and was demanded of him in a vision." End quote. And so, Charles Freeman was sent to the Danvers Lunatic Asylum. He was mostly forgotten about until October of 1880, when this short article appeared in the October 7th, 1880 edition of the Boston Globe. Now, see if you can find any room for improvement in terms of journalism. Quote, "Freeman of Pocasset is reported to have escaped from the Danvers Asylum, and the report is denied. Charles Freeman, the Pocasset child murderer, escaped from the Danvers Insane Asylum this morning. Regarding the reported escape from the Danvers Insane Asylum of Freeman, the Pocasset murderer, not much can be definitely learned. On Thursday night, a man called at the asylum with a package for Freeman, and the latter could not be found either in his ward or bakery where he had been recently employed. Later, a messenger was told that Freeman and two others had escaped. This morning, the attendants state that Freeman is safe, but that a German patient named Fritz has gone. Another story is that Freeman and two others were sent out to hang clothes, and all three escaped. It is believed in Danvers that the first story is true." End quote. I had to backtrack to see what the first story was. I think it's the story that the German patient named Fritz has actually escaped. It's kind of hard to tell. No Pulitzer Prizes for that article. Freeman remained at Danvers until December 5th, 1883, when he was retried for his case. According to the blog for the podcast In My Footsteps, quote, "In the time since the death of little Edith, Charles's religious rantings had abated. Hattie Freeman took the stand during the trial, now saying that she had seen through the delusions that had previously blinded her. Dr. Munsell believed that Charles was not of sound mind when he committed the heinous murder due to several reasons. He chalked it up to Freeman's long service in the military, being overworked for years, a rough bout of diphtheria, and finally the small town life of Pocasset leaving him in need of guidance, which he found in the Second Adventists. Five other physicians corroborated Munsell's theory. Charles Freeman was found not guilty by reason of insanity on December 6, 1883, after the jury deliberated for a mere 10 minutes. Freeman was returned to Danvers State Hospital. He remained there, appearing to be of sound mind the longer he got away from his time as a Second Adventist. On March 17, 1887, Charles Freeman was discharged from the hospital, being classified as not insane. He did not return to Cape Cod after leaving Danvers, opting to move his family to Chicago. Charles F. Freeman died on November 4th, 1928, at the age of 82 in Lawrence, Michigan. His wife, Hattie, died 2 years earlier in 1926 at the age of 79. Bessie Freeman, who was 6 years old when her father murdered her sister, lived until the age of 82, dying in 1954. End quote. And as for little Edith, she was buried in an unmarked grave in Pocasset Cemetery, her life all but lost to history. And that is where I will end the incredibly tragic story of the murder of Edith Freeman and the life of Charles Freeman. Like I mentioned at the beginning, it's so hard to learn about these stories, but I think this one sort of nicely captures how much some of the patients believe their delusions when they commit their crimes. To some, it is a perfectly reasonable or logical reaction to a problem. And so many of them believe it's a life or death situation. So I have more stories from Danvers for you. So please stay tuned for those. As always, thank you so much for listening. Thank you for joining the Facebook group and Instagram pages. I added a post on both of those sites asking for questions. If you have any questions for me about these old hospitals, about my work in hospitals, like at least as much as I can answer without violating HIPAA, or about being a psychologist in general, I would love to hear those. So feel free to post them on Facebook or Instagram, or email me at behindthewallspodcast@gmail.com. While you're there, also check out the Beacons and Patreon pages. There should be new material added to the Patreon page by the end of this week, so stay tuned. And as always, remember, do the best you can until you know better. And then when you know better, do better. Until next time. Thank you so much for listening to Behind the Walls of the World Psychiatric Hospitals. Once again, I'm your host, Dr. Sarah Gallup. Cover image is by Christopher Payne. Check out my website at behindthewallspodcast.buzzsprout.com. Follow the podcast and learn more on Facebook at Behind the Walls Podcast and Instagram at Behind the Walls Pod. For questions or recommendations, email me at behindthewallspodcast@gmail.com. You can find new episodes every Monday on Amazon Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening right now. If you like the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people find and listen to the show, and I would be so grateful. Please stay tuned for more episodes of Behind the Walls of the World Psychiatric Hospitals. Until next time.